Accession number 28776, Reel 8.
Admiral Sir Raymond Lydall, Reel 8.
Admiral, after you'd done some service in the Arctic and off Norway, what was the next stage?
Well, we came back to Leon Solent. We were disembarked, but eventually we had to fly down, I think, from obviously from Scapa Flow or wherever we were launched, and down gradually through the UK to Leon Solent, and we were sent on leave. And the squadron was increased from 12 aircraft to 24. And it's unbelievable, but I mean, by that time, we'd started off with 14 pilots in the squadron, with 12 aircraft, 14 pilots. And I think there were five of us left at the end of that deployment. Some had been killed, quite a few, sadly, and others were time expired and time to go and have a rest and do something. I think five of us were left, and they then sent two brand new courses out of the Naval Air Fighter School at Henstridge to join us. So we were swamped with ab initio pilots, really. And so we formed up at Leon Solent. We didn't have long because their new aircraft arrived. They'd all had to be checked. And so and then it was time to embark in Indefatigable to go off to the Far East. And the CO, this man I didn't like particularly, Wingington, had gone, and the senior pilot, who was Andrew Thompson, who was a young man, he was only 24, I suppose, suddenly found himself the wing leader, CO of 887, and 894 was the other squadron. We had the high level aircraft, they had the low level aircraft. They were increased to 18 aircraft, we were increased to 24. So here we're talking about 42 Seafires, you know, to be embarked in Indefatigable. And strange to relate, we had to embark from, the carrier was going to be in the Irish Sea, off Anglesey. And so we had to fly up to Mona in Anglesey. And Andrew decided to take us up in a bell boat, you know, and unbelievable when you think about it. Anyway, we all got airborne and got formed up in this great gaggle of aeroplanes and started off towards the north. And as you can imagine, I mean, the weather just came down and down until, you know, and the hills came up and up. And so I went up through cloud with my number two, who, I'm trying to remember his name now, I had two, and they were both killed before we even reached the aircraft carrier. I think Brooks was the first one, and Norman, I think, was the other one. It may have been the other way around. Anyway, I had this chap tucked in against, and off we went up through cloud. And I came out at the top, and he wasn't there. So he'd lost me at some point on the way up. And later, I discovered he'd collided with the Wellington, and they were all killed, the whole lot of them. So I came out of the top, and in those days, I mean, there were no radio aids or anything like that. So I looked around for a hole to go back down and find out where you were. So there was a hole, and I came down through it, and there was a Lancaster with its wheels down. And I thought, right, he's going into an airfield, I'll follow him. So I followed him, and then, much to his annoyance, I'm sure, nipped in front of him and landed. And I can't remember being in my logbook where we were. Somewhere in the south of it, somewhere in the middle, you know. And the only other Seafire that arrived there was a CO, funny enough, my CO. The two of us, the rest were scattered all over the south of England, apart from this one that I'd lost, which had been killed. So we sat there for a day, for a bit, and waited until the weather cleared, and then we all flew back to Leon Solent again to have another try. And this time he was a bit more rational in what he did and sent the squadron off flight by flight so that we had a better chance of getting there. And this time, we got to Mona. Only were there for a very short space of time. I was then given another number two, which was, I think, Norman. And so we flew out to embark in Indefatigable. And there she was, and I came round and landed on. And in those days, you didn't hang about on the flight deck because of all the disasters that were taking place. So as soon as you landed on, you know, you went, got below. So I went down and got into my cabin, or found the cabin I'd been allocated, and got myself sorted out and went down to the wardroom, And in the wardroom, somebody said to me, "What happened to your number two?" And I said, "What? I don't know. What happened to him?" Because he was behind me. He spun in downwind. So I'd lost two before we'd even embarked. And so then we were all landed on, and the hatches were battened down because the ship then was going straight down to off the forest now. And so there was no flying, and we just went hell for leather down through the Bay of Biscay to through the Straits of Gibraltar, right through the Mediterranean. We never stopped, we didn't do any flying at all until we got through, and we got in then. The first stop we had was Alexandria. We stopped in Alex, and before we went through, that was my experience with the Middle East, and it's in my book, I think. But I remember going ashore with a couple of chaps to have a, and we sat in a wayside cafe, and two episodes I remember very well, or three, I suppose. But the first was, I thought, well, I'll buy a paper. There was an English paper. I'll buy a paper, so I bought a paper. And then I realised after a while I'd paid three times as much as the price of the paper for yesterday's paper. It wasn't today's at all, so I thought, right. And the next thing was that a little boy came along, wanted to clean my shoes. I said, no, I don't need my shoes cleaned. And the waiter said, no, I think you ought to have them cleaned. So I had them cleaned. Otherwise, he was going to throw muck all over them. So I thought, well... And then, of course, the usual business with the gharry, and the great trick with the gharry was to hire a gharry to go back to the dockyard. And then the lads would drop out of the gharry one at a time, and the last man out would... But the idea of them was to set fire to the... had a kind of basket of hay hanging underneath to set fire to the hay, to see the gharry with nobody in it roaring down the streets with the hay on fire. So no wonder we are not particularly loved. But on the other hand, why, it's rather interesting that, as I say, in all my innocence, I went ashore and got done twice in the space of a few minutes. So I suppose it's mutual. I picked up a nasty bug there of dysentery, I suppose. And so I wasn't very well going through the canal and out the other side and then through the Red Sea. And then we started flying. We started to do some flying. And... My cousin was the PMO at in Asmara, I suppose it was, in what had been Italian Somaliland. And I'd written to him to say that, you know, I was coming up in the carrier, and if it was possible, I would come ashore to try to get to see him. And when we were coming down, so I said to the CEO, can I go ashore? And he said, well, and he talked to one and said no. He said, you know, if anything went wrong and the airplane went unserviceable, we'd never get you back again. So, but we were flying. There was a lad called Subaltern Jones, I remember very well, who couldn't get his hook down. So he was diverted ashore to Asmara, or whatever this place was. And when he got to the coast, of course, in those days, it was nothing, just a coastline, a desert. And he had a choice of turning left or turning right, and he turned right, which was the wrong way, ran out of fuel and finished up in the desert. And of course the next thing, my cousin, who is the PMO there, hears that there's a sea fire gone down into the, and he immediately assumes that it's it is he, and was terrified that if he didn't do something about it, my mother would never forgive him. So he goes roaring off on a camel to try to find, of course they found Subaltern Jones, not me, but and he was all right. He ditched in the desert. But so we'd lost another aeroplane. Anyway, we then... there was a little bit of flying there, and then we arrived in Colombo. And we were disembarked at this extraordinary place just opened called Catacaranda, which was... I was looking with all these disasters in Ceylon recently. I was wondering exactly where Catacaranda would have been. But it was down in that area, and it was just a clearing in the desert, in the jungle, I should say, and extraordinary dispersed kind of camp. And we descended on them just before Christmas. That would have been in 1944, I suppose, 44 years, 44. And so there they were absolutely saturated with all these young aviators suddenly descending on them. But that's a long and boring story of all the kind of misadventures we had there. But the tragedy there was that we lost yet airplanes were unserviceable, and I went down one morning and to the dispersal, and the duty officer was a chap called Winston Ostergaard, who had been a friend of mine, and was a friend of mine. And he'd gone off, he'd left a note saying, they're all unserviceable. He said, well, I'm taking whatever this airplane is for a test flight. At that moment, there was a puff of smoke, and he crashed after takeoff, had an engine failure, into the jungle. And very stupidly, although very naturally, I mean, the CEO and I leapt into a jeep and roared over to the site, and there, of course, the airplane was a mass of flames, and there was Winston in his outline in ash, sitting in the car. I mean, it's terrible. A scene I've never forgotten. Nothing we could do. And so that was that. So that was, and we flew a bit from there, did a bit of flying, and then embarked again and sailed for this shakedown cruise prior to going to the Pacific. And the shakedown cruise was to go off to attack the oil refiners at Palembang and Panklin Brandon. And so off we went. And once again, well, this really was the first time in that part of the world that we had been on operations. And so the way they decided to operate the Seafires was that my squadron, the F-3s, the high-flying airplanes, were put up at 20,000, 30,000 feet on combat air patrol to make sure if anything came in, we were there to deal with it. And our friends in 894, which had the L2Cs, the low-level aircraft, flew a box around the fleet, 2-2-2-2, and you just flew up and down at about 500 feet, looking out all the time to see if anything came in, because radar was still quite good. I mean, we did have fighter direction, but I mean, it wasn't all that good. So we didn't have airborne early warning. And so these chaps were actually the eyes of the fleet, looking out to see if anything came in low level. And of course, all the Japanese attacks on us came in at low level. They were all sallies and things like this. And we never saw anything at altitude at all. And so all the fun was being had by our friends in 894 down below. And they did extremely well. They shot a hell of a lot of airplanes down. And although Admiral Vian had been very hostile to the Seafire because of its poor deck performance and the fact that it had very short endurance, which meant the fleet had to keep turning into wind to recover, compared with Corsairs and Hellcats from the United States, which we had a whole lot on lease land by this time. Nevertheless, the fact that they hacked down so many aircraft or attacking the fleet really rehabilitated us in his eyes, I think. Although it was nothing to do with us, we were up at altitude, denying the skies to people who didn't want to be there. So we came back and refueled and then went out for another attack on the Indonesian mainland. And many years later, when I was running British Aerospace and we were selling Hawk trainers to the Indonesian Air Force, I went and called on the president, was it Ben Sukarno or Suharto, I forget which one. And he said to me, this is your first visit to Indonesia. And I said, in a manner of speaking, it is. And he said, I came before, but I didn't land. And I explained, and he said, oh, I remember it very well. He did an enormous damage to the oil installations which the Japanese had. So that was that. We finished that and then tailed it for Australia. I went into
Fremantle,
isn't it? Yeah, to fuel, and then round to Sydney. And of course, it was a great business being in Australia, and we were made extremely welcome. And when we were disembarked there for a short while, were we disembarked there? I'm trying to remember. We weren't there for very long, so I don't think we were disembarked. We weren't for very long, and then we were off to the up north to the Pacific. And we were given a shakedown attack on one of the islands. And then we also did an attack on Formosa. When I say we did an attack, I mean the air group did an attack. The Equatorial Sea Fires were up there patrolling and all the rest of it. So that's what it was in the briefing. I never forgot the briefings in Formosa, as it was in those days, where the briefing was that if you had an engine failure or something, or were damaged, the place to come down was in the middle of Formosa, where they were very kind of primitive people, but there was a better chance of survival than getting down on the plains with the Japanese. And we were all given these, what were known as ghoulie chips. These were a bag of gold coins, Dutch coins, so that you could bribe your way out of any situation you found yourself in. Well, I'm not too sure. Because in that, at the same time, some ridiculous things happened. I mean, we were given Australian hats, you know, these big kind of hats that Australians wear. Because there's no way you could wear such a thing or put such a thing into a CFAR cockpit. And revolvers and machetes and all, and there's no way you could get all this stuff in. No way. So all this survival kit that you were given, you couldn't carry it with you. The one thing that was, but that was attached to your Mae West, was a dye marker. And this dye marker proved to be extremely valuable and saved the life of certainly one fellow I remember, Jimmy Hayes, who was shot at by something or the other. And you only needed one bullet in a CFAR's coolant system, and that was it. You were going to ditch, and he ditched in the middle of the Pacific somewhere, but was seen by a chap called Dick Reynolds, who was an absolute ace guy. And he was seen because the dye marker had this great green patch on the surface, and that was how he was identified. Otherwise, he would not have. And we were given, I remember, these silk charts of the area with the currents on them. So the idea being that, you know, you might eventually be washed ashore. I mean, come on. And so that's when we started, after we'd had our shakedown cruise there, we then proceeded up to the Sakishima Gunto, the tail end of Japan, where we were attacking Okinawa and that area.
Could I ask, Admiral, if there was any rescue...
We had a sea otter on board, you know, and that would go cranking off. And I remember when we were operating against Palembang, and there was a lake in the middle there, and the otter was supposed to go out and land on the lake if necessary, and chaps were supposed to try and land, you know, ditch nearby, and he would pick them up. So it was all a bit ad hoc, and so. You know, that was but it mainly, of course, it was the destroyer escorters, plane guard for both launch and recovery.
And were you aware at that time, obviously, of how the Japanese often treated airmen?
We knew that it wasn't very pleasant, and we knew that the chances of survival if you were caught by the Japanese was it's not very good. So we didn't look forward to that. But as I say, from our own point of view. In 887, we were always flying combat patrol over the fleet, so we weren't going over Japanese territory as much as our Avenger colleagues and the chaps in the Firefly squadrons who were actually doing the groundwork. So we then, as I say, operated, and the scheme of operation there was 4 days up and 2 days back. That is to say, we'd operate for 4 days. Then we withdraw to the fleet train, where they would bring up supplies, fuel, food, all the things we had to have to sustain us, and new aircraft, replacement aircraft. And so we'd have a comparatively rest period while we were operating out of range of the Japanese aircraft, but being replenished. And I got quite... keen on being one of the volunteers to go over to collect aircraft, because the ships that brought them up were American escort carriers, and they came complete when those ships came with all the American gear that they had in them, and they had the most marvellous coffee. So the reason I liked to go over there was so I get a decent cup of coffee and then bring an aircraft back into to Indefact. So that was and they devised, of course, because you had to be transferred. There weren't helicopter transfers, so you were transferred by jackstay to a destroyer, and the destroyer that would then go over to the escort carrier, then you'd be jackstayed across to that. So some clever chap in one of the escort carriers, I suppose, or one of the destroyers, had this bright idea that he would transfer four pilots at a time on a on a jackstay. And the way they did this was to put a kind of RSJ, a short RSJ, hanging off the actual runner, and then you'd have a kind of great big canvas bag on each end. You put two pilots in each bag. I've never seen anything like it, and I witnessed this the first time. And of course, the funny thing, strop broke, and they all went in the oggin. And of course, you were then going to be dragged behind in these kinds of canvas bags. And bloody dangerous. And so I remember coming back and saying to Whitfeld, who was the commander of Indefatigable, and I said, "Sir, you'll never believe." And I told him, he said, "I don't believe you, and they're not doing that." So the captain then made a signal, and the admiral stopped it completely. And so we had to be sent over one at a time. And so it took a little longer, but it was by the side safer.
What was your impressions of the Americans on the escort carriers?
We didn't see any Americans.
Oh, were they British?
They were American ships, but manned by the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, of course, by that time. Well, the tankers and supply ships, but the actual carriers were not. They were manned by the Royal Navy. So no, we didn't meet up with. The first time we met up with Americans was when we got to Ulithi in the Carolinas, which had been cleared by the by the Americans, and we arrived there, and I had a chap flying with me, my number two, and he had an engine failure. His engine stopped, and he ditched on an island in the Ulithi group, and was all right, and on a spit of beach there. And then we came back, and so this was the first time we were ashore, because Americans had a recreational place ashore in Ulithi, and I went ashore, like a lot of other people, into this place. And of course, what they had ashore was a thing. They had this stuff called, it was a chocolate drink, and I kind of have a terrible sweet tooth, and I just couldn't stop drinking this chocolate drink. I didn't want to drink any of the alcohol, thank you very much. Of course, if you had about six cans of that, it was guaranteed to make you sick practically. But then, of course, we brought the Americans back, who couldn't believe that on our ships we could actually have alcohol. So it was a bit difficult controlling this mob, if you it got a bit out of control. But I then went off with the senior pilot, who was a Dutchman of our squadron, and the engineer officer, to try and see what we could get out of this aircraft that had ditched, like short-term supply stores and spares. To rob it, we couldn't get the aircraft, but we could get bits out of it. And it was the only island in the group that had women left on board, left there. And we walked into the local village with our Dutch senior pilot, and I went in. And it was quite funny. The first time I'd seen a genuine grass skirt, which was rather thicker than those which you'd seen previously. And it was interesting. It was very difficult talking to the head man, because the men all lived in one kind of shed, and the women were in another one, and so unmarried men were all in one big group. And on this island, of course, there were enormous quantities of debris that was being washed up ashore, and endless crates of cigarettes and things like that, and they'd taken all the things that were not damaged by the sea and stored carefully, and the head man would ration them out to the locals. There were no young men. They'd all been taken by the Japanese to work in slave camps somewhere else. And they lived off coconuts and pigs, and they had pigs there and chickens and things like that. And he communicated with this Dutchman, did with this ship, with kind of broken German, because the Carolinas had been part of German possessions before the 1418 war, and so they spoke that, but not very, and we didn't have any Japanese, so that was how he communicated. But that was an interesting experience, and it came off from there. But after that, it was up off Okinawa, and just 4 days up and 2 days back, and 4 days up and 2 days back. And this went on, I think it was the longest period that any British fleet had been at sea at that time. And at the end of that long period, we went back to Sydney to replenish. Remember that I didn't realise, as a young sub-lieutenant, what was I to know, is how difficult it was for the admiral commanding that fleet, because we had no logistic support. We had never done replenishment at sea. We'd never done anything like that before. And so it was all brand new and had to be digested. We didn't have any ships that were really properly equipped for that kind of thing. But it was make and mend, as usual. And it worked. I mean, and they did a fantastic job. Of course, they never got the credit, I think, for doing a fantastic job, because the Americans were so much better organized and so much larger in their the contingents they had there. So it was never. And of course, by this time, the war in England, in Europe, was over. And so people had forgotten the war, and it was then known as the Forgotten Fleet out there in the Pacific. And we went back to Sydney, and I was then relieved, along with one or two others who had finished our first line tour of duty. At that time it was, I think, 15 months or something like that in a frontline squadron embarked, and then you had 6 months rest ashore, and then you went back again. So I was sent ashore for my rest. And I was sent, first of all, I was at Schofields, where they had taken 24 pilots from the Royal Australian Air Force, dressed them up in naval uniforms, and they were going to start the Royal Australian Naval Aviation, which was what they did. And I then went down to Nara, which was a support base a little bit farther down south, for a rest, where I was flying. I can't remember what now, it doesn't matter. And then later, and then I re-embarked in Implacable, with all these Australians, they all then joined. The war by this time was over. The war was over while I was disembarked to Nara. But I remember in Ulithi talking about the Implacable had come out to join the fleet. We'd had some damage to. I can't remember, because we were formidable and victorious, and which a lot for attacks and a lot for damage. Hindi Fat, of course, was hit by a kamikaze while I was airborne. I was in the crew room waiting to get airborne. The airplanes were spotted, and the fighter direction officer on broadcast came out saying a raid approaching at so many miles, getting close, and they manned aircraft, I manned my aircraft. I was number two to take off, and as I took off, so I saw this zero up here in front of me with a big red spot on it, and so I ripped up the undercarriage, turned the gun side on, pulled the stick, but I mean, it was hopeless, it was up here, no way I could get it. And he was still turned and went straight into the ship behind me, and I saw the ship disappear in a mass of flames. So I was very lucky just to get airborne before that kamikaze struck. We then, of course, were airborne for an hour and a half before we came back and landed on in the,